You're listening to a Rare Drop podcast. Check us out at raredrop.co.
Hey everyone, Kevin here, asking you to head over to our Patreon and check it out. Enjoy benefits like exclusive content, merch discounts, and behind-the-scenes looks at all things Rare Drop. Go to patreon.com/raredrop to become a member today, and thank you so much to our current patrons who helped make this show possible. Dave the New Nerd, Neil Anderson, Jack DeVille, Philip Snyder, Jedi Chappie, Paul Marzik, Aether Mana, Respect KS, Petey Club, Wow Dad, Justin McMahon, Stephen Purd, Matt LaRue, and all of the other patrons. Thank you so much.
Explore epic sagas with Rare Drop Roleplay. Recap the latest in sports with Overplayed. Unleash your inner hero on comics. Dive into a galaxy far, far away through Star Wars and Scotch. And pick the brains of industry experts on Broman Podcast. Whatever you're looking for, Rare Drop Entertainment has you covered. Check out our full lineup at raredrop.co.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Broman Podcast, episode 139 with Jason Bischkoff, director of licensing and I believe strategic acquisitions or something like that at Funko Pop.
Sure.
I'm just trying to perfectly remember your LinkedIn profile.
Oh, yeah. Here, I'll put on my formal bow tie for a second.
Oh, here we go.
Director of Global Licensing and Business Development.
That's it. Global Licensing and Business Development at Funko Pop. So I guess my first question is, everybody knows what, like, about Funko Pop now. Like, it's huge. The first time I encountered it was like, God, I don't even know. It feels like it's been around for a long time. Like, I'd always see it at PAX. So my first question is, when did you join up with Funko Pop?
Like, oh, that's a great question. Well, first and foremost, thank you for having me. That's cool of you. I'm stoked to be here. And, you know, I love that we're going to be able to engage and just kind of have this rad discussion today. So thank you for that. So I'm going to dive in. Yeah, I will say that I started here at Funko about 2 years ago, formally. Informally, 7-8 years ago, I was at Blizzard at the time and actually signed one of the first then licenses to Funko, which was World of Warcraft. So it feels like it was a million years ago. In reality, it was still kind of in the budding days of it evolving as kind of a collectible unto itself. But yeah, I've had a lot of contact with Funko through the years. I'm just formally here about 2 years now.
2 years. So, oh man, I just realized that I jacked up my capture really quick. Hang on.
No problem.
That's just me. Everybody's watching the video. It's like, wow, that's a really cool image of OBS.
Should I pretend to freeze frame?
Yeah. Yes. So 2 years ago is actually really interesting because, like, that means you probably joined up right before the old global meltdown and everybody going inside. But that's been, for the collectible space, that's actually been really interesting and advantageous. So, like, as an economic mechanism throughout quarantine, a lot of people have seen, like, or at least I've been paying attention, like, everything that is collectible has been skyrocketing in value. Like, people have really started collecting Pokemon cards at a greater rate, you know, baseball cards, all these things from my childhood that are sort of, you know, now they're like, oh, well, I have to have that, you know, up to, God, I mean, I'm trying to remember even like an original Mario NES cart getting sold for like almost $1 million after getting graded, or maybe it was like 1.2. So like that's the collectible space is something that I've always been around my whole life. How has the increased amount of attention on collectibles over, I guess, the past 2 years, your time here, how has that changed the way that Funko Pop's been like approaching things, or how has that informed your approach?
Oh, sure. I mean, that's a multifaceted question.
Yeah.
Right?
Take as long as you need. It's a big question.
No, it's good. So you're absolutely right. There's an environmental factor that changed in many respects the nature of our business, or if anything, compressed pieces and then opened other kinds of opportunities. So first and foremost, I'll just kind of blanket say it, and I take off my Funko hat for a second. Funko's done a lot of good and a lot of right in its short history, right? Company's like 25 years old or so.
Yeah.
And when Pop first came out, I mean, they did a really good job very quickly of accelerating the volume of licenses that they had access to, establishing those studio relationships, sophisticating the form factor, getting it into as many hands as possible. And then more than anything, to your point of collectability, like really making it a collection of collectibles. They weren't just infinitely produced toys that anybody had access to at all times, right? There was a chase value there that was baked into the nature of the product that has gone on to serve it indefinitely. So that's great. What 2020 ultimately did is it forced us, I think, in my opinion, it forced us to really double down in some respects. Like, people have never wanted to collect our stuff more. There's never been more cool stuff to collect in general. Like, the studios are actually producing volumes of content now that just not, and on platforms that just not, did not exist 2 years ago. So we have, you know, we have these huge and broad stretching licenses to tackle all that cool stuff that's coming in, that's capturing people's attention, but it's also capturing a wider audience because they're stuck at home. And it's kind of poking the nostalgia bear because they can't go outside and engage with people in a different way, you know? So there's a slurry of factors here that have gone into it. What it's produced in 2 years' time is just new levels of engagement for us. And to your point, like, people double or tripling down on this idea of it really being a collection of collectibles. You know, there have been to some extent availability issues because of that demand. But, you know, these things are all being addressed in real time and we're dialing in towards the issue. Really, at the end of the day, what it means is we're doing something right. We're doing it in a way that's very highly engaging to people. We're doing the stuff that matters most to them, that has real emotional resonance. And we're trying to, you know, deliver it in the coolest possible form factor so that we can just, you know, continue to keep people hype and engaged with what we're doing and ultimately with what our studio partners are doing. So kind of, I know there's a lot in that stew there.
No, that's excellent. So what I'm hearing is, like, and you brought up such an incredible point, right? You already have all of these partners. And so as they have pivoted to this new delivery system of all their content, right? Like, in 2019, Disney was not doing launch movies on Disney Plus. Like, that probably wasn't even in Disney's pocketbook yet. Like, that, you know, I think it surprised everybody. That's why it took so long into the pandemic when everyone's like, why are movies going to theaters? Like, I have Disney Plus at home. Why can't I get it? So it really changed things. And the volume game increased at the same time, right? Especially now, I think a lot of studios were moving into more, especially with the most recent round of, like, NVIDIA production tools and things like that. You can do so much with AI that if you're doing animated content, which a lot of your partners do, you can churn that out at an incredible rate. So trying to keep pace with that, that's got to be difficult.
It can be. The other thing I think that we all just take for granted is the idea that, like, franchises are a thing. You know, frankly speaking, 5 years ago, we didn't think about franchises in the way that we think about them today. And everything is a franchise now, right? So I that's probably a whole topic for another day. But what I'm going to say here is, like, there is this huge interest from a cultural perspective in the idea of these baked worlds being regularly explored at different angles, right?
Yes.
And we have seen sort of the Hollywood studio machine step away from the idea of a traditional franchise as just feature film and then subsequent sequels, and moving into kind of this dynamic model of feature film, feature television. There's a publishing component or an interactive component. And I'm very grateful to say that I've actually sat on some of these teams as we've been composing those kinds of elements and thinking about franchises and kind of these 360 construct. But that's just a roundabout way of saying that there's never been more content and there's never been more diversity of content. And on top of the idea that everybody's trying to create these franchise worlds, you know, like, I am old enough to remember a time where all of us were combing the internet for that sense of community and connectivity around a thing that we loved.
Right.
Well before that was established in even a profitable medium, you know, like, I'll kind of choose something out of the ether here, but like for a time you'd have to comb Reddit to find like, oh, all the big ghost heads that were really into Ghostbusters, the first two films and the animated series, and then Extreme Ghostbusters from the 90s. And that was it. That's all you had. Franchise was nothing more than just like people in a Reddit thread kind of sharing the things that they loved or finding new ways to express that love. Right.
Right.
Now it's so much more formalized, more stuff to choose from, worlds completely being reinvented. I mean, look at something like, you know, Star Wars and the Mandalorian, right?
Yeah.
Mandalorian completely reinvented the game for Star Wars, and it sort of reinvented the lens by which they are going to do a lot of storytelling. So I know I'm down the rabbit hole here, Ben, but like...
No, it's great.
it's a lot. There's a lot of stuff to chase, and yeah. The reason why there's a lot of stuff to chase is because there's new ways to tell these stories, and in some instances, the audience is a part of that story. So people are really, like... They're invested, right?
Yeah.
And of course, when they're invested, that means they want to see and display that emotional resonance elsewhere and outside of their minds. That's where things like collectibles can come into play, because without having to watch a show, you can look at a pop on the shelf and be like, feels, you know?
Yeah.
And that's very valuable to us, both from like the people that are maintaining franchises to us ultimately selling consumer products around characters that we really care about.
That's, you know, I really do appreciate how, because I was curious about how this part of the conversation would go. I was going to ask you directly about like selection criteria, but it's sort of really obvious that you're pulling from so many different locations to try and put together an endpoint consumer product that's trying to encapsulate this entire universe, right? Like if you're going to make a Mando product, it needs to be contextualized down to like really fine details to really give it that. And that's something that Funko Pop, I think, has always done really well. Anytime I've ever gotten something from you, I'm not like not a hyper observant person. So like anytime I get a Funko Pop, I'm like, oh, it's so cool. So cool. And I'll show it off on stream and someone will be like, oh, did you look at the inside of the right of the wrist? And you'll notice that they have this specific design from like whatever that lets you know X, Y, and Z about that. And I was like, wow. Like, so taking something from a massive universe and then turning it into like a hyper specific product that's really going to nod to the fandom of the entire franchise is like, it's a heady problem to solve.
Sure. And I guess I would just say it in the most simplest of ways, which is like Funko's mantra is everyone's a fan of something. And the reality is everyone inside is also equally a fan of something or some things, right? So
yeah.
It's really, you know, it's fans making product for fans. Like we legitimately care, you know, tip to tail here on, doesn't matter if you are the finance guy or the licensing guy or, you know, the product development gal or whomever it might be. Everybody is really passionate, really cares about these things. And we are as protective in many cases as our licensors. And so of course, like authenticity is key to what really makes our stuff so compelling. Because we want to put it on our shelf as much as you do. And that's really what gets us out of bed every day.
So when it comes to working with these massive, IPs that you all partner with, because I mean, I think throughout my experience as a content creator and a fan of media, it seems that at this point there isn't a space where Funko isn't creating something, for you to pick up, whether that's movies, music, games, television shows, like all of it. So what is it like trying to work with some of these larger partners? Is it like, do you get an order sheet? I'm sure everybody's super interested. Like, are they like, does Walt Disney send you a personal letter that's like, I would like to create, you know, this many Star Wars Funko Pops? Or
sure.
Like, as I'm super fascinated about that process.
Sure. So
if you can share, if you can't,
I can share a little bit, which is that, some of it is driven by, you know, what's in the content. If there are two characters or 20 characters, that makes a difference. Mm. Some of it is driven by retail demand. Some of it is driven by fan demand. you know, it's kind of a coalescence of a number of factors. But really, at the end of the day, if people are excited and they're picking this stuff up, and there's momentum there, then of course we're going to continue to chase it and do more. And sometimes we test it and it takes a while to ramp up. And sometimes we just go out the gate with a whole heavy offering of goodies. But I think we're just trying to be conscious of, like, really at the end of the day, sure, it's great to program, you know, what can we produce versus, you know, how much, how sensitive do we have to be on the part of our fans and how much they have to spend this month or whatever. I mean, all those things come into play, but really at the end of the day, it's about cool factor, right?
Yeah.
What is the ultimate achievement of cool factor? And if we can answer that at the end of the of every day, I think we've done the job.
So when it comes to making something cool, is there like a standard procedure for you all? You're like, this is neat, but how do I make it cool?
Yeah, there's definitely a process, right? Right. And a lot of that starts at the strategic level. And then in many respects, it comes through the incredible lens of our creative folks. We do it, of course, all in partnership with our studio friends. So yeah. I want to be clear that like every single pop or any product that we're ultimately producing, it's done by a very select committee of influencers, and they can be a broad diversity of folks across, you know, multiple disciplines. At the end of the day, everybody just wants to come at this with a goal of, you know, what is the best possible execution, or what's the thing that really geeks us out? That's a right. common question. So, you know, we just try to do the brand service. We try to do ourselves right and do our fans right. I know it's a bit abstract, but the reality is it's incredible creative people working with other incredible creative people, and then ta-da, babies are born.
I mean, it's abstract, it's art, right? Like you have to deal right. with, you take the big, weird, hefty concept and turn it into a thing. And that process is always really hard to describe. You know, it's hard to nail that down. So what I was hearing there and what I think super interesting is that you mentioned that you're always working hand in hand with your studio partners. So every product's kind of a collaborative effort. What is it like, I guess, on what level are you collaborating? Is it like you're going to get creative from studio and a creative from Funko Pop and get them in a room together and have them talk? Or is it like, you know, you sit down and it's like a board meeting, like, oh, it can't be, you know, those pants are that's not the right, you know. That's not the right whatever RGB color red. So like it's not no. Like what is that like?
The answer is yes.
Ah.
what I mean by that is
yes.
I've worked at other companies. I've worked on the licensor end of the spectrum. I've worked on the licensee end of the spectrum. Funko is by definition usually the licensee in those relationships. But the answer is yes. Like there are standing meetings every week. And when we are so privileged to do so, we throw ourselves in a room and have a brainstorm or just a side conversation. And then sometimes it becomes a tactical, like, what is the Pantone color of Mando's pants? You know, like, right. because that stuff's important and that's brand integrity. But really, the answer is yes. It's all of these things. It's a very long relationship to create any one given product. Some companies, it takes 12, 14, 18 months to produce something from scratch. We work historically a little faster. But, you know, we're always trying to get into a more advanced cycle. But I will say that one of the things that I truly love about working here is just how dynamic we can be and how quick we can react to something.
I was going to ask you about timelines on stuff, because so today, like with consumer products and everything being like really fast, or people getting, especially now with digital collectibles becoming something at the forefront, right?
Yeah.
It's really interesting to be working on a longer timeline against something like that. And I think that the brand history that you have, what I love about Funko Pop, I didn't want to interrupt you earlier, but what I love about Funko was, you know, for me, it's always been something I like most of my life. I was like, oh, that's cute. That's neat. Neat.
Right.
And then, you know, but you work with so many things. And then I think it was Game of Thrones stuff. You launched like that. And I was like, oh, gotta buy all of it. Like, you know, I was so caught up in that fandom that I wanted that like physical anchor in my home. And so I it's really interesting that you're bringing things to market that are unique in like a marketplace of immediate satisfaction, you know?
Sure.
So what is it, I guess, when you're looking towards the future, how is Funko Pop, or how have you started looking at the digital collectible space?
Sure. Good question. So, you know, I spent almost a decade at a video game company, and I can tell you it's very different. The life cycle of creating product for a video game as a patch or as DLC or whatever. I mean, literally, you could be reactive in a matter of hours,
right.
Nonetheless, weeks or months, unless you're creating something whole cloth, which, you know, a game, especially like a AAA title, can take a couple years of development, if not more.
Yeah.
It's a bit different on the consumer products end of the spectrum, just based on the nature of what you're doing. There's literal, you are manifesting abstract into physical reality and then having to produce it at a large volume. So it takes months, and then it takes months to ship that stuff across the globe. And,
yeah,
you know, for us, our goal, I think it's just like any good author. If we've done our job, you can't see us, right?
Mm.
The magical thing that you wanted just appeared on shelf at the time when you wanted it most.
Mm.
That's our goal, right? That you
right.
cannot see the gears for the machine. And I think we do a damn good job of it.
Oh, totally.
That being said, you know, digital is different. It's digital. It's different for the nature of our business, because we've done only so much of it selectively. And we're constantly trying to be on the bleeding edge of kind of what it means to collect. So, you know, these days we're looking at everything. You know, there are initiatives like Funko Pop Blitz, which is our mobile game, that have really kind of challenged us from an art development and pipeline support standpoint to like, how do we feed 5 new digital pops into that game every week, every week, and do that in partnership with our friends at Network. And there are other initiatives too, like Digital Pop, which
gave me heart palpitations.
Yeah,
the project
yeah,
you just described, like consistently updating a game with 5 things
every
per week,
single week
from with corporate partners. And I like all your considerations. So you have, like, have Disney considerations, you have all the game considerations,
yeah,
music and everything. And now you want to put them inside of another environment.
Yeah.
What's that like managing that? Do you have like constant stress?
The reality is, on that particular title, we've got it dialed in. Network's awesome. We're leveraging a lot of existing creative, which really helps in the overall process. But it, you know, it is a lot of heavy lifting. It is a lot of work. But my hope is that it's worth it to those folks that are just excited about playing as their favorite characters in our pop stylization in a game that really matters to them, right?
Oh yeah.
So
there's nothing like playing as your favorite character.
What's that?
I said there's nothing like playing as your favorite character.
Oh, nothing. Like when the game launched, for example, you know, I'm a huge Back to the Future fan. So the idea that I could drop Marty into the puzzle board, use his super, see the DeLorean break into frame, leave the flame trails, and burn the board heads off the table. It's just like, I don't know. It's that sticky. It's that thing inside of you that just is tickled pink to not only see the character in action, but to some extent have agency over their actions, you know, like that's just cool. Right.
Yeah.
So to answer your question, like, I don't know, it's complicated. Like we're just trying to do the coolest possible stuff in the newest and most interesting avenues and ensure that we are doing so and delivering with a degree of, again, here's the key word, authenticity to us and authenticity to our partners. And provided it's authentic and people feel like they have a platform to participate, I think, again, job well done, right?
Yeah, that is fascinating. So you mentioned in there about, you know, coming from the gaming space where you have really quick turnaround to resolve things. And now you're here where like production time pipeline is way different. Was that a difficult adaptation for you, like as a person, to go from being able to quick respond? Here's my example. When,
sure,
you know, I'm used to streaming, right? And I run all my social media. And so when we started doing, you know, consulting at Rare Drop to help bring people into the space and all the different charities that we're now working with and things like that, helping with social media plans was part of that. And so I'm used to just being like, let's do this. And then everybody I'm working with is highly competent, right? Like in the streaming space, everybody is their own director, an audio engineer, network engineer, social media manager, like, you know, you do everything. So I had this faulty assumption that, oh, it's easy. And so folks will come to me and they'll be like, oh, we want to set this media marketing plan. I was like, awesome. It'll only take like 2 weeks because like, yeah. I'm thinking it, you know, if I sit down with all my streamer friends and we wanted to set out a year of marketing for ourselves, 2 weeks would be more than enough time. You know, you sit down, you get the game calendar, right? Like you can lay it out. It's simple. You know, I almost gave our now COO, Mindy, panic attack because she's from the traditional marketing space and understood those timelines. And so part of what I've been learning, you know, from her as we've grown as a company is like, I need to take a step back and understand traditional timelines. So yeah, sure. Like that was my experience. So I'm super fascinated what it was like for you.
Okay. I'm going to go backwards to front. So on Perfect. That specifically, I would challenge you to sure learn about the traditional, but stick to your guns, like the things that made you successful. Like,
oh, yeah.
Don't shed those things in favor of falling into a norm schedule. Mm. Because I would argue that many of the good folks, your audience included, are coming to you because of the speed at which you are producing totally. At the level at which you are producing it. Right. Yeah. Now, don't burn yourself out by any means, brother. But
yeah.
But like, that's part of the magic of what makes you, you, I would argue. In terms of, you know, for my transition, I mean, I'm kind of a professional weirdo. I'm just going to kind of put that out there. I've had the great privilege of being in the licensing, entertainment, consumer goods space, the better part of like 16, 17 years. I started at Playmates Toys working on Ninja Turtles as a consumer product. Did that for 3 years, which was like a dream come true. And then I made the transition into video games. But even then I was working on like the physical product component for as much as there were some digital components that were still a part of it. Did that for almost a decade and then, you know, jumped to Power Rangers for 3 years. And then now I'm here at Funko for two.
Yeah.
So the answer is like, there's always been some degree of a quote unquote traditional manufacturing backbone or through line through many of these positions. It's just been, what's the expression of the needs of the day, in and on top of that sort of ever present column of throughput.
That's awesome. So you were just like, I'm ready for a new challenge. Like I'm ready to look at things differently.
It's just like adaptive. It's same tools, different day. Right. And that's really what it boils down to is in every position I've held, you know, I'm just very grateful to say that like you kind of learn as you go, you build up your tools. And then hopefully you approach each and every day, with enough humility to think that the tools you have couldn't be improved. Right.
yes.
So that's really kind of been my story, my professional story thus far, but it comes with a lot of appreciation for what everybody else's pipeline looks like. Right.
Yeah.
A big part of what I'm able to do now is because I know and can respect what a digital pipeline is versus a physical pipeline.
Right.
And what's the best overlap of those two streams. So I don't know, it's strategic, it's broken every day, and hopefully you've got good enough tools that you can put it back together again.
Yeah, that is putting out the fires and all that stuff. So I got to shift gears. What do you look for when you're out there looking for something new? Like let's say that there is, you know, an IP or something that's out there that you haven't brought into your network yet.
Yeah.
What sort of things are you looking for? What represents a strong IP that you think, oh, okay, well, this is somebody we should merchandise with and we should work on licensing things.
Sure. I think anybody in licensing would arguably say that it comes down to, or I would argue, hopefully, if you're in licensing, you're doing it because you really care, like you're really resonant with something. Mm. For us, that tends to be one of the biggest North Stars and what we're chasing. I don't want to create any sort of illusion that I make any sort of decisions exclusively. There's entire communities of people internally that we're regularly polling for, you know, what makes sense or what we should be going after. I'm very grateful to say top to bottom, everybody's a fan. And, and again, just to kind of double down on that sentiment, all the time we get notes from our CEO or our president or our CCO about like, hey, I fell into this over the weekend. It's the coolest thing I've ever seen or heard. Clearly there's a lot of people talking about it. Let's just kind of explore it. Does it make sense for us? Yeah. So it comes from all directions. And I think generally speaking, more than anything else, we're looking for stuff that really connects for people. And I know that's a little like, maybe that's a little hippy dippy, but it's, I think what it's meant to say is that like, if people care, and we just have to kind of use the litmus test of, would they care enough to see that thing on their desk every day, in their kitchens, in their office? That's the first and foremost question, right?
So it turns into, so it's the consumer endpoint, right? It's, is this something that's valuable enough to like pick up desk space, something like that?
Well, yeah. And let me be clear, like we're constantly casting our nets, and equally so we get petitioned all the time for us to look at other people's stuff.
That's gonna be my next question.
And you know, I will tell you that 95% of the time it's a no. Right. So everybody has great product, but that doesn't mean it's going to make, it's going to equally make good product for us or through us. So it's a bit complicated, but really more than anything else is, are we fans first and foremost? That's a good first test.
Yeah. I like that. So going along that route with, the rise of the content creator and the digital influencer and, you know, however people want to define the other part of my job. How does that play into all this? Is there, you know, I've seen some attempts to do similar style products of where, you know, you're trying to turn influencers into a little collectible device or item. What do you think about that whole process? Like, where do you think that could go in the future?
Professor Roman, are you pitching me right now?
I'm not. I know that I don't have a big enough community to try and get a Funko Pop, but I mean, like, there's, you know, like there's people out there who can command more attention than entire franchises of movies, right? So I'm curious. How does one approach that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a question I think that we're answering regularly every day. I would say that you're absolutely right. More people at this moment in time, more people are engaged with individuals and perceiving them as brands than ever before, right?
Yeah.
And in many respects, you develop that kind of emotional resonance with a person or group, and it really matters to you, right? Like, I'll give you a good example. My wife and I are huge Try Guys fans. And we've been following them for years, and we listen to the podcasts, and we watch, you know, twice weekly or whatever. We bought the book, you know, like we're into it. So to your point, like, yeah, big parts of society are being motivated by these individuals. And I think you'd be foolish not to ask the question, is this valuable? Is it resonant enough that we should start having a conversation around consumer products? I will tell you that, like, I don't know if there's a definitive answer here. It really comes down to what's the temperature of the day. And we've only done, at least from a Funko perspective, we've only done this selectively. And I don't know how to answer it other than to simply say that, like, it is a thing, but I don't know if it's as mature as we need it to be just yet to be a more prevalent part of our overall portfolio.
That makes a lot of sense, right? That's the... And this is the thing, right? And this is what I'm discovering a lot with gaming and influencers and everything that's evolving, is that there is this massive growing economy behind, you know, creators and attention and individuals as brands, which I love the way that you put that, right? Like, you know, random Joe Schmo on Twitter that ends up with, you know, maybe they end up with 100,000 followers just because they tweet memes, right? Like, that individual... Sure. is going to naturally seek out, oh, like, well, I should get some branding done. I should do all this other stuff. A decade ago, maybe that would still happen. But like 20 years ago, no way a normal No way a normal motherfucker walking around is going to be like, oh, you know what? I got a lot of attention. Let me get a logo and sell some shirts and all this other stuff. Like the default business acumen of like, I got my shot. Now, what do I do? That's there. Like, that's in place. I think for me, one of the things that I've been unlearning after being in industry and in content creation for so long is that every industry has its like necessary titration period where it's like, we are too risk averse to engage in, you know, producing a whole bunch of products for an economic space that's like 10 years old and unproven. Sure. Because it takes and I love that we had so much discussion before this. There is so much machinery to move. to get one thing on a shelf. And you know, you're dealing with legal and everything else, like all the way top to bottom. And then to grab an individual as big or small as their business might be, and then just say like, we're going to produce a whole bunch of stuff behind this when you have no idea if that individual streamer is just going to drop off the face of the planet in the next year.
Sure.
So there's that.
I'm going to kind of piggyback off what you're saying here a little bit. So I think what I've observed as a fan and individual, this new media space, which even by a term is kind of antiquated, but go with me.
Yeah, at this point, yeah.
But like this space specifically is so fascinating to me because it is, I mean this in the adjective way, not in the literal way, it is twitchy, right? Like it's so impulse driven. It's so driven by the moment and your relationship with an individual in a very specific space. And to me, in the abstract, it takes a lot to ask the digital fan, the follower. It takes a lot to ask them to log out of their computer, get into their car, drive to the store, search for a thing on a shelf, pick up that widget, come home and put it on display, like, or wear it or whatever. It makes so much more sense to me if you minimize the amount of clicks from I want a thing to I have the thing. If it lives natively in the space in which you are most resonant and you are most prevalent, that feels more native as a transaction, like literally and figuratively.
Yeah.
And so I think like the future for me, as best as I can kind of discern it and read the tea leaves here, the future for me for like consumer products around content creators is literally in the space in which they occupy and are most comfortable, right? Mm. Like I don't know if I would go to Target or Hot Topic to pick up a Hot Ones t-shirt.
Right.
But I would probably buy it instantly online if I saw it and it was right there at my fingertips, right?
Yeah.
And so it's just a question of like, how does that dynamism work when I'm engaging with you in this way? Like, what is the definition of that dynamic such that like you can leverage it as a brand? Because that excitement is valuable.
Right.
And again, I'm a bit down the rabbit hole here, but like there's something really
fascinating. This is exactly why people listen to the podcast. Go as far down the rabbit hole as you want.
All right. but that's really what I mean. It's just like, look, you live in this space. People want to engage with you in this space. And I think you should be building.
I have a dog.
You're good.
Let's
get
my dog really quick.
You're totally fine.
I can still hear you.
But I think people just want, they're here for you now in this space specifically. So if you're building a plan or you're building a strategy, in my opinion, it should be in which the house you've already built. You know, dogs are otherwise, but in the digital house in which you built, right? Like that is the shortest possible connection between you and everybody out there that's engaging with you is literally this space. So how do you leverage this space?
Yeah. So you brought up so much stuff there. I got totally distracted.
It's fine. You're good.
I think that you're right. Right. There's so much room for growth in the creator space. And there's a lot of, I mean, we're still seeing it now. Like there's a lot of unresolved conflicts. Right. And I don't mean like there's problems. It's more that there are like legal rules or understandings that haven't been reached between, like, as a standard operating agreement, right? Like, if you were to go to a business to business meeting with a potential new, you know, IP you want to work with, there's standard operating procedure based off of, like, are they, you know, this type of franchise, I assume, like, are they a game? Are they a movie? Is it an individual IP, something like that? But if it's an influencer, if it's somebody who's just got like a massive online following, like, the rules in many places haven't been written for those kind of relationships yet. Yeah. And so you're talking about taking on something that's relatively high risk. And then you're talking about writing the playbook. And then, and that's one of the things I've learned, like, looking at larger companies, like, that's tenuous, because if you write the playbook, it exists and anyone can use it, right? It doesn't, you know, like, you can NDA it to death, but like the first time, like, all it takes is one person emailing one thing. And then now everybody has like, oh, this is it. Like, this is how we work with influencers. This is how we move all this stuff forward. And so everybody, I feel like sometimes there's holdback because it's like, we don't want to be the first people to do it. Like, we want someone else who might be smarter than us to figure it out, or, you know, and then depending on how the executives are making decisions, it's like, we might want to watch somebody else crash and burn on this. You know, like, we don't want to, because there's a whole lot to win if you get there first, but there's so much to lose if you show up, overinvest, and it blows up and disappears. So, like, this is like, for me, this is really fun because it's like an affirmation of everything I've been learning since I started streaming in like 2013, right? Like,
and that's a long time. That's an eon in terms of this market and this angle specifically.
Yeah, I feel ancient.
You're not.
I know. But that's the thing, right? Like, it's like the warp, right? Like, if you go if on Twitch, you know, flopping back and forth between like traditional business and doing content creation, it is mind numbing sometimes, because it is like, you're working on a timeline that's like 5 months out here, and that's fast. And then, you know, I step into another role and I'm like, oh, if I can't get this done tomorrow, I might as well not do it, 'cause it's not fast enough.
Yep.
And so you're just constantly dealing with the, like, this variable acceleration, and talking this out is helping me realize why, like, a lot of people kind of stay away. They're like, oh, these people, like, they're doing great. They're making money. That's awesome. But, like, have you heard them talk about their job? Like, they're sure. And that's the other, I think that's another huge part of it, is that a lot of what we're doing on our end, creating content, there's no playbook for that either. When I first started streaming, I like to talk about it, or content creation, like, like a traditional union. Like, I was born and raised in like St. Louis. My dad is from Chicago. So, like, you know, I was around union types of jobs my whole life. And, you know, it takes 10 years to become a journeyman, and it takes, you know, 15 years and all these tests to become, you know, whatever, or I think it was 20 or 25, become like a master plumber. Right.
Yep.
But once you're there, like, you've attained that skill, like, this space hasn't even lived long enough. Like, it's just been around long enough that there are enough journeyman level, you know, union members to sort of like start this process of defining the shape of what this whole thing is, right? There isn't a round table of everyone who's been doing this for 50 years and who've had like proven strong careers that are all diverse. Like, this guy played sports games, this guy did RPGs, and this guy was variety, and they've all been crushingly successful. And so when they sit down and talk, we should listen. Right now, it's everybody just being like, I think I'm right. And the market's still figuring it out.
Okay. So, wow. So much to unpack.
I love it. Great.
I'm going to rewind a little bit earlier in the conversation where you were talking about the differential between being on the bleeding edge and then having to sustain and feed kind of like a more traditional channel. So you're absolutely right. I think you've identified something that is our practical everyday and reality. which is all of the spaces, all of the retail spaces, even in some cases, the e-commerce platforms, all of these spaces primarily are defined by like the least common denominator, the thing that we are all aware of. Like you're going to go to Target or you're going to go to Amazon for the most part, and you're going to go into these spaces looking for the brands that you know, right?
Right.
And they stock those things, whatever they are, widgets or shirts or whatever, they stock those things based on a general assumption that they need to have like enough of the basic stuff that everybody's looking for in order to be a sustained business, right?
Yeah.
So they are driven by the idea of kind of a traditional play, least common denominator mentality, the stuff that is biggest and most resonant from a franchise perspective. That can be literally a franchise, like a franchise world, or it can be like the vacuum cleaner brand that most people know, right?
Yeah.
They are driven by this idea to be the most general thing to the broadest number of people, but right. Also they have an appetite to be or to find or to generate the next big thing. So that can add brand equity to them, and it could kind of capture a whole audience that's never maybe even been in a like a Target or on Amazon or whatever it is.
Yeah.
So this is this weird space of like, how do you throttle that line as bringing in the stuff that everybody is expecting, but also trying to like innovate and be something new or deliver something new? And that's where that liminal space is literally where like our business lives. It's almost every business I've ever been a part of. And to your point, the magic is how do you write a playbook that works within those defined spaces and then has other elements that help complement and bring it all together as kind of one chorus. So further still to your point, as you're talking about people that live in your speciality, like people that live in this, it's a wild frontier of streaming, right? Or even just content creation in general. For me, it's very interesting because when I was in school, I minored in anthropology. And one of the most prevalent ideas in anthropology is this idea of job specialization. You've got enough like general resource in a society that people don't have to be a doctor. They can literally be a generalist and a brain surgeon and a gastronomical expert. And right. like you have strata of expertise, and with each expertise, there's a higher level of value that the culture places on that person, right? Yeah. So I think that's what's happening in the content creation space. The reality is YouTube or whatever, or Twitch, like these are agnostic. They do not care about what is being featured, unfortunately, right?
Truth.
What they care about is that people are engaged. And people are arguably most engaged when they find like the thing that is most specialized to their interests.
Yeah.
So it's not just about like BewTube. They're literally looking for a BewTube influencer that's really dialed into RuPaul's Drag Race and is exploring like whatever it is, you know?
Yeah.
And to your point, like people have had to create brands unto themselves within this space in order to stand out. You can't just be like generic person in a tuxedo, you know?
Yeah.
Like you have to be known for your personality. You have to understand the brand at which you are producing at your content level. So like, dude, there is so much baked into this, but you're absolutely right in saying that it is being rewritten every single day. Everybody's got a different approach. And fascinating to me is this juxtaposition of traditional infrastructure and high value targets that are on the bleeding edge. And where do you find that convergence between those two audiences? That's alchemy. And there's so much value to be found there, but few people can do it well.
Yeah. That's what we've been trying to do at GCX every year, you know, and it's building an event like that for out of nothing and then trying to get people to buy in to it and things like that. It really is like we have rewritten how that event runs on the back end, especially for creators pretty much every year because I'm in tune and Tim Darkness 429's in tune with the space. Kevin was super in tune because he used to stream all the time, but like we're there every day. So if we see something come up or something's being talked about, you know, like when you're talking shop, right, with other broadcasters, you know, oh, well, like, this is a predictive need. Like, if we approach them as an event with these things already solved for them, they'll more than likely they'll want to attend, and also it'll increase the joy of their experience there, you know. So for us, we always have like the front facing thing with GCX, where we really want to engage people. We want to sell tickets, obviously. We want to raise money for St. Jude. But the thing that a lot of folks don't see is that we desperately try to help figure out the other side of the equation. What is it like to bring in? What is it like to responsibly bring in 400 to 500 content creators and give them the value that they're seeking out of the event in a programmatic way? Because there's no way we could do white glove service for everybody, even though I personally wish we could. But there's time constraints. And so figuring that out, that has evolved every year, and it has made, you know, it's always made our head spin. And because there isn't a playbook.
Yeah. And well, I know it's a bit, again, it's kind of like, it's a bit antiquated to simply mention it, but like, once upon a time, I remember when Penny Arcade was like a biweekly comic that people just kind of went to a web page of all things, like a dedicated web page. And I remember them literally blogging for the first time, like, hey, we're thinking of doing a meetup in the Seattle area.
Yeah.
Right. And they probably went into it with similar goals, which is like, hey, you guys really care. We really care about you. We think we can do something a little bit different in person that we can't do through this one medium. And so they took a risk, and they built a community that now has become kind of a staple of the video game space, which is, you know, PAX, right? And now there's a PAX East and a PAX West. So what you're doing is just, it's fascinating to me, and it's good work. Not only for what you've got going on the back end, which is critical, like the idea that you were supporting, sustaining elements of St. Jude's, like, kudos and God bless you for doing it. Right. And the fact that you are doing the good work of community building and enabling people in the best possible way, and trying to save them a little bit of time and rough road that you've had to travel. Like, I don't know, man, it gets a bit spiritual and philosophical, but you know, I constantly use this this analogy of like, I am just a fellow pilgrim on the road, and it seems like, you know, you are doing you're kind of doing the Lord's work here, so to speak, of being a fellow good steward and pilgrim on the road, right?
That is that. I mean, no, that's totally how I feel. But that's my that is my way, right? I had a bit of a rough go of most of my life, and I always told myself, if I ever do anything no one else has ever done, I'm not going to be the asshole that just like walks up the side of the mountain, doesn't like drop flags on the way up. And because the only way to move a space forward is to recognize when you're a trailblazer, and to accept, begrudgingly or otherwise, that you're a leader. Tough shit. I think that is something from the content creation side. I think it's something that everybody accepts now, is that if you have a large channel, you're a community leader. But when I got started, that was a debate. People were having this debate of like, so what if I have 3 million followers? Like, it doesn't matter what I say. Like, I'm just a guy and I'm whatever the hell. And like, I don't have a community. Like, these are just people who want. And so there were these discussions about even the aspect of leadership associated with growing along with these, as you stated, agnostic platforms that really just want to grab attention. So bringing all of that together into what we do at GCX, it always has me intrigued about how other people do that kind of creation, you know?
Well, and I'm going to piggyback off that, because if I can draw from my own experience, again, I'm a professional weirdo. The kinds of things that I've been able to see, say, you know, touch, engage with, like, if I were to tell my 7-year-old me the things that I get to do on a daily basis, little Jason's head would literally explode, right?
Yeah.
And I have to like kind of drill this home. I am exceptionally grateful to be able to do what I'm doing, and I'm very grateful for every step that's taken me to this moment in time. Those steps did not happen independently. It always came as a product of knowing somebody, or somebody who was gracious enough to extend a hand or an opportunity. And so I am right there with you. I absolutely subscribe to this idea that I certainly didn't get here on my own. And I have a responsibility in many respects to extend that same hand in all directions, because that's the only way we ever get anywhere, right? Is yeah. like, if you try to think about it in a bit more in an abstract way, I am literally shaking hands, kind of going up, hopefully up through a chain of individuals that have lasted through, you know, their careers and or through history. So it is equally yeah. my responsibility to extend my hand backwards, forwards, in whatever direction I can to pull people with me, because that's the only way anybody really ever gets anywhere. Yeah. So again, kudos to you, because it seems like, you know, you grappled with this idea, this philosophy of I've been given, ergo I have to give. And yeah. I think that that is, it seems like you're employing that philosophy in the right way. So again, like, God bless you, dude. That's awesome.
Thank you. That's I'm bad at taking compliments. Thank you.
I'm working.
Yeah, no, I'm working really hard not to try and negate compliments immediately. That's like something we're working on with my therapist. You know, she's like, you know that when you do that, like, people are like, oh, I don't know, just take the compliment. I'm like, yeah, okay, yeah. fine, okay. That's how she always hooks me. She's like, but what would they think? And I'm like, oh, damn it. I got away sure, from it, sure. and then now I have to come back. And I was like, yes, of course. Now I'm still doing what I want. Yeah, it's great. Like, you know, therapy's fun.
Would it help if I tipped in the chat? Is that a better way?
Oh, my God. That still makes me uncomfortable after a decade. Somebody sure. comes in, they tip like a dollar, and they're like, hey, man. Oh, well, now it's like, hey, man, I started watching you when I just got into high school, and now I'm graduating yep. college.
Yep.
And I'm like, yep. I was not ready to have an existential crisis at like 10:30 in the morning.
Yeah.
But that's the way things have grown. So we're coming up on our time here. And this has been an absolutely phenomenal conversation. So I'm going to ask you this. If you could give a piece of advice to somebody who is, you know, let's say looking for a career in like the merchandising space, or who sure. might know about your career path and that's why they're tuning in. Do you have any advice for somebody who might be starting their journey sometime soon?
Yeah, so absolutely. It's the same advice that was given to me in high school. And I've been pretty consistent about repeating this as often as I can. So if you want to get into entertainment, consumer products, actual content production, whatever it is, really, you have to imagine like your goal as the center of a target. And you need to start throwing bolts against that target. What I mean by that is you have to work your way center. You cannot expect to just shoot bullseye. Does it happen? Sure, it happens. But those people are entirely the exception to the rule. What I would instead encourage you to do is think about where it is you want to go and find any way to break into the overall industry. It doesn't matter what it is you're doing, just break into the industry and constantly refine your game and work your way center. That's how you get closer and closer in a very realistic and practical way. So let me be straight. If you want to work in the entertainment space and you are currently engaged at like, and I do not mean to belittle this by any means whatsoever, but if you are working at Enterprise Rent-A-Car, that the applicable experience between Enterprise Rent-A-Car and being a production assistant somewhere else, while it may seem like it makes sense on paper, it does not necessarily make sense to the person that's going to be looking for that person, right?
That is very fair. That is very fair and good advice.
You have to start low. You have to say yes a lot. You have to refine that aim and game and work your way center. That's my general advice.
That was beautifully defined. I think that matches the story of so many people who I've had on and who I've had a chance to talk to at various events, where it's like, I used to be a forum moderator, and then one day they were like, do you want to do part-time community management? We'll pay you. We're thinking about making this a field. And then they're the full-time, you know, for AAA studio. And I've heard that story so many times. And so there, you know, right now there are so many places in my mind that are like being a forum manager, you know, whether sure. that is being a knowledge specialist on TikTok and talking really in a really educated way about your specific franchise. And then you get, you know, like, again, like I from working with all the organizations we do, if you can speak articulately about games, gaming, and the social medias attached to it, if you can just do that, you have absolutely no idea how much that would blow everyone else's resumes out of the water.
Yeah, like, 100%.
I've spoken about this on stream before, but I fundamentally believe that pretty much every vertical or style of company is eventually going to need a gaming specialist on their team. Yep. And I don't care if you're Enterprise Rent-A-Car or if you're Target or if you're like, you know, a national grocery chain.
Yep.
Somebody is going to be in that Fortune 500 company in maybe even the executive boardroom saying, this is how we are getting our products in front of the gaming industry.
Yep.
And that's happening. And so just like you said, if your goal is to get into that boardroom, working adjacently to like just getting involved in gaming, creating specialized content and building a community around it, showing that you can, you know, manage that kind of energy and prove yourself to be an effective communicator about it, it will go so far for you.
Infinitely so. And if I can add one small addendum to that, there's really only two ways. Once you've found yourself on ground floor, there's only two ways. You can either build up or claw or tear down, right?
Right.
And okay. I would highly encourage you, if you're watching today, regardless of what it is that you do, regardless of where you want to go, I would argue favor lawful good, go for build up. Because tear down comes with consequences that you may not appreciate today, right? Like yeah. If you are an industry that is requiring you to build bridges and you're in the business of burning them, good luck. But build up is my general advice.
What a beautiful note to end on. thank you so much for joining me today. I absolutely loved our conversation. This is probably one of the most insightful business conversations. I say this every time we have a business professional from like a different vertical on. But this was phenomenal. I learned a lot. I appreciate your insights. If you are listening or if you're watching this later live, thank you so much. If you do anything, please share this with somebody who it made, you know, if you thought of somebody when you were listening to this, please share it with them. You can review or any of the other stuff if you want. But you know, I want to get this knowledge to the people who need to hear it. Make sure to check out the rest of the Rare Drop roster of podcasts as well. This is something I've done a bad job of doing in the past. So here, check it out. You can go to Rare Drop. We have Star Wars and Scotch. It's coming out. They have like a whole bunch of special episodes next week. We got the WTF podcast coming back, and we have Studio Blank for all of you anime nerds. So whatever you want to listen to, we've got it. And now you can't avoid the bumper. I got you. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll talk to you next time. Bye, everybody.
Thanks, everyone.